thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. Former Alderman Ed Burke is sentenced in court today. We have a live report from the federal courthouse. 2 years ago, the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade. We take a look at the impact today. And five asylum seekers who journeyed to Chicago are profiled in the new WTTW digital series, Firsthand Homeless, The Migrant Experience. And now to some of today's top stories. Chicago police officials have made significant changes to the way the department intends to handle protests during the Democratic National Convention in August. The department's previous mass arrest policy had come under scrutiny from a coalition of police reform groups who say the original version violated protesters' First Amendment rights. Officials tell WTTW News that under the revised plan, officers will be prohibited from arresting people engaged in First Amendment protests for, quote, minor or petty offenses or for actions that pose no immediate threat to public safety or property. The ACLU of Illinois, which represents the coalition, says while it does not endorse this new policy, it is a substantial improvement. For more on that, please visit our website. Meanwhile, the Democratic National Convention is officially moving into the United Center today to start prepping for the big event just 8 weeks away. It's the same spot that hosted the 1996 convention when former President Bill Clinton was nominated for re-election.
We are learning each day how to build a convention. If anyone tells you we have been here before, we have been in this building before. But this convention will be different. It will be exciting.
The DNC says today's move marks a key milestone in the planning process. Crews were seen on the floor of the center transforming what is typically a sports arena into a convention hall for the convention's primetime programming. Cook County and Chicago officials are remembering Cook County Commissioner Dennis Deer today. Deer died on Sunday. He'd represented the 2nd District of Cook County since 2017. He was born and raised on the West Side, where he continued to live with his wife and three children. His death was announced on social media. County Board President Tony Preckwinkle said, quote, "He was a fierce champion of equity in every space he entered. In addition to serving on the Cook County Board of Commissioners, he was a psychological clinician by training. His expertise, guidance, and commanding voice made us all better and were critical in his role as vice chair of the Cook County Health Board of Directors." Mayor Brandon Johnson, who served with Deer when they were both on the county board, remembered him as, among other things, a tireless advocate for the underserved and underrepresented. Deer was 51 years old. There's no word on his cause of death, but the family says they will share more details soon and request privacy at this time. Up next, indicted former Alderman Ed Burke has been hit with prison time and a hefty fine. Heather Sharone with that story right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
$2 million. That's the sentence a federal judge handed down to former Alderman Ed Burke. 2 years in prison and a $2 million fine, a lighter-than-expected sentence for the man who was once the most powerful elected official in Chicago. Burke is now convicted of operating at City Hall like a mafia don, shaking down those who needed help from their elected leaders. WTTW News reporter Heather Sharone joins us now from the Dirksen Federal Courthouse, where she was in the courtroom when Burke was sentenced. Heather, take us inside that courtroom when the sentence came down.
Well, when Burke was listening to U.S. District Court Judge Virginia Kendall hand down his sentence, he showed no visible emotion as she went through the various offenses he has been convicted of, which include racketeering, attempted extortion, attempted bribery, and all 13 counts of crimes. Now, his wife, former Illinois Supreme Court Justice Ann Burke, did show emotion. She sobbed uncontrollably as the judge read out the sentence, which was much lighter than anybody expected going into this. We also heard for the first time from Ed Burke in his own words, more than 5 years after federal officials raided his city hall offices. He expressed regret for causing his family and friends pain, and he said the end of his storied career, that blame lies only with him. Truly a dramatic moment today.
And Heather, prosecutors urged the judge to sentence Burke to 10 years in prison. His attorneys asked for home confinement. How did the U.S. District Court Judge Virginia Kendall settle on those 2 years?
Well, she said she strived to strike a middle ground, encouraged mostly by the hundreds of letters that were sent into the court in advance of today's sentencing. But she said she disregarded the letters from the powerful and the high profile and instead focused on the letters from people who lived in Burke's 14th Ward on the Southwest Side and said he was there for them when they needed him on the worst days of their lives, when a relative was dead, a job was lost. Ed Burke, they said, was there with a consoling hug, money if they needed it, help getting a job if that's what they needed, or simply his prayers. Now, it was truly an amazing moment as Kendall sort of seemed a little bit overcome by the emotion that she read in these letters. And it is clear that the defense's strategy of painting a more holistic picture of the former powerful politician at City Hall paid off in just 2 years of prison time, as well as that hefty fine.
And Heather, prosecutors urged the judge to use Burke's sentence to send a message to other politicians who might be also tempted to break the law. Do we know if the judge took that into consideration?
She said she did. She said that it's crimes like Burke that weaken the fabric of our democracy and make it impossible for regular people to trust in the rule of law. But she said that there was really no indication that a tough sentence for Burke would have any other impact on politicians who are considering using their public office to enrich themselves. She said it seems to be a problem without an answer.
And Heather, Burke also faces that $2 million fine and the loss of his pension. How much might that hurt him?
So the loss of his pension is going to be significant, there's no doubt, but he could write a check for that $2 million fine today. We know from federal court records that he has a net worth of more than $30 million. In addition, he has $8 million left over in his campaign finance funds. That, of course, was amassed over decades as he consolidated his power in City Hall and raised money across the city.
Yeah, okay. It sounds like the 2 years in prison, obviously, much more upsetting to his wife, former state Supreme Court Justice Ann Burke. Heather Sharone, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brandis.
You can read Heather's full story on our website. That's WTTW.com/news. Up next, marking 2 years since the Dobbs decision, a look at the impact. Stay with us. More and more people are coming to the state of Illinois in search of abortion care in the 2 years since the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision overturned the 50-year Roe v. Wade ruling. Planned Parenthood of Illinois says 25% of its patients are from out of state, compared to about 4% pre-Dobbs. While clinics say they were prepared for the influx, the future of all reproductive care is still under threat. Joining us now are Michelle Lando, the Chief Operating Officer of Hope Clinic in Granite City, Illinois; Jocelyn Gill, the Assistant Health Center Manager for Planned Parenthood of Illinois in Flossmoor; and Leslie Moore Hicks, the Associate Medical Director from Planned Parenthood of Illinois in Waukegan. Thanks to all three of you for joining us. I want to start by asking each of you what your clinics has had to do or have had to do to adapt in these last 2 years. Leslie Moore Hicks, let's start with you, please.
Hi, thank you very much. I would like to say that we have adapted very well by increasing a lot of our services, especially for our abortion patients. Part of that also included us opening our Carbondale location, and Jocelyn can speak more to the expansion that they have in plus more in terms of making access the number one priority for a lot of our abortion patients.
Jocelyn, same question to you.
Yeah, so here specifically at the Flossmoor location.
Jocelyn, sorry, I'm afraid. I think we might have lost your audio.
Oh, sorry.
There you are. It's okay.
Sorry. So kind of like Leslie mentioned, we have increased our services in order to be able to accommodate the increase in patients that we have seen. So we've increased from 2 abortion days to now 4. And that is both for the medication and the surgical and procedural abortion. In addition to that, we have increased staffing to also better accommodate the increase in patients.
Okay. And Michelle, same question to you about what your clinic has had to do to adapt to this influx.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. Well, Hope Clinic has been providing abortion care in Southern Illinois since 1974. And over those 50 years, we've definitely had to adapt to a lot of changes. But post-Dobbs specifically, we've done similar things as Jocelyn and Leslie have both mentioned. Specifically, we have added on an entire day of clinic. So we increased our clinic days from 5 days a week to 6 days a week. We do offer medication and in-clinic abortions on all of those days, as well as increased our staffing capacity by 40%.
Jocelyn Gill, back to you. Of course, you all did a lot of prep in anticipation of the Dobbs decision leading up to it before the decision actually came down, of course, 2 years ago. Was that enough for, was, you know, what you anticipated enough? Has it turned out the way you planned for?
I would say so. Other than the increase in the days that we've had to add onto the abortion days, I would say so. We've had sufficient staffing to allow us to accommodate the increase in patients, and also we have a lovely it's a abortion travel team that assists us in all of our locations to kind of fill in those gaps on the days that we don't necessarily have sufficient staffing. So they have been great and a big part of being able to support this increase in patients.
Michelle Lando, what can you say about some of the unintended consequences that this has had on patients?
Well, you know, over 80% of our patients come from out of state. We see patients from 28 different states and 4 different countries. In 2023, that was the number. And one thing that has definitely taken a lot of attention from our staff and our leadership has been, you know, kind of working with these patients as well as working with practical support funds and abortion funds to ensure that there's not only access here in Granite City, but equitable access in order to remove barriers such as not only financial barriers, but travel barriers, cost of childcare, food, things like that, that go along with, you know, having to travel so far out of your home state to obtain abortion care.
Mm-hmm. Leslie Moore Hicks, you've also been treating patients who are looking to access gender affirming care. What are some of the risks that they face by not having easy access to that care?
The risks that they face are vast, in the same way that we can see those risks to our abortion patients. What we know is that when patients have an interruption in getting the medications that they need to continue on their transformation journey, it can be problematic even from a mental health standpoint as well from a physical standpoint. So a lot of our patients do rely on the fact that they're able to stay on these medications in a timely fashion. And even our newer patients that are looking to start the transition process would like to be able to do so without the burden of running into barriers where they cannot obtain these medications in their home states.
And Jocelyn, what are some of the barriers that patients are facing now post-Dobbs? I think you've had at least one patient, but some who've had to get through many hurdles. What are some of those?
Yeah, similarly to what Michelle stated earlier, travel, work, you know, not being able to take the time off, childcare, along with the additional expenses of lodging, food, Those are all additional things that we have seen. And thankfully, we do have additional resources and programs to help these patients. But for sure, I would say those are the biggest barriers for us.
Leslie, are you seeing patients that are farther along in their pregnancies? Maybe it's taken them a while to sort of gather the resources that they needed to make the trip. Or are they in more, you know, severe health conditions sometimes?
We actually see a lot of patients along the continuum. We see them as early as 6 weeks, as far as even beyond the 22 weeks that we offer here at Planned Parenthood of Illinois. But we do have services in place to assist those patients with other partnerships, kind of like HOPE, as well as other partnerships that we have with other organizations and even some out-of-state organizations that will take patients even further along in their pregnancies. So we do work very closely with our behavioral health staff, our abortion navigators, to help our patients at the minute they call us. We try to figure out the best way for those patients to be seen.
What are some of the health impacts on a patient who's had to wait? Does that make their cases a bit riskier?
It can. Once they get to a certain gestational age, it becomes a two-day procedure for a lot of our patients. And so that also impacts kind of what Jocelyn and Michelle were both saying, how the duration that they stay, housing implications, those kinds of things, lodging overnight. So it can definitely impact the further gestation that they are. Some of the health concerns that they have. And then some people have health concerns that may not be, that may be contraindicated to using just the medication pills alone, and they may have to get a procedural process for their terminations. And so we take all of those into considerations with all of our patients equally.
Okay, that's where we'll have to leave it. I want to thank the three of you for joining us, Leslie Moore Hicks, Jocelyn Gill, and Michelle Lando. Thank you. Best of luck to you. Up next, WTTW's digital series First Hand returns with an inside look at Chicago's migrant experience. Right after this. In the past 2 years, nearly 44,000 migrants have made the long, arduous journey from their home countries in South America to Chicago. The new WTTW digital series, First Hand Homeless, The Migrant Experience, follows five asylum seekers on their ways to finding housing, employment, education, and a better life. Here's a look.
Hay diferentes números de puertas, entonces esa es la que en ese tiempo estaba abierta para los migrantes. Teníamos que hacer una fila. Duré 3 días haciendo la fila. Y el calor y todo, el sol, se me partieron la planta de los pies.
And joining us is Edgar Vargas, producer and director of First Hand Homeless, The Migrant Experience. Edgar, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
So we just watched the clip, of course, about an asylum seeker from Ecuador. His name is Esteban. Can you tell us more about his story?
Well, I met Esteban at the mission at St. Edmund's Church in Oak Park. And part of enterprising these stories was talking to a lot of people. And many of them, even though they committed to do the stories, after a few days, they would just say no. So I just decided I would hang out at the mission. And with the help of one of the volunteers, Celine Woznica, she got me in touch with Esteban. And the tact I used, rather than to tell them I wanted to do a documentary on their life story here in Chicago, was just to get to know them. Just to, how you doing? What are some of the challenges that you're going through right now? And because I think, as you know, it takes a little while to gain someone's trust. And I needed that if we were going to tell these stories.
There's also a story of Jose, a family man. He's working around the clock to provide for his family. You followed him with his kids to the barber shop and because they wanted to get their hair cut, of course, mm-hmm. to look good the day before their immigration hearing, which was the next day where, you know, heading in. He's clearly a bit nervous. How would you describe that day and sort of helping him? Did you find yourself helping him navigate downtown?
The haircuts were done on Tuesday, and his immigration court appearance was on Wednesday. And I could tell him, I asked him, Jose, what's wrong? And he said, he goes, well, he's nervous. You know, he goes, everything that happens tomorrow is the beginning of the rest of my life. So I said, don't worry about it. I'm going to go there to immigration court and meet you. I said, just know that they won't let me in. Okay, but I'm going to go there, I'm going to greet you, make sure you park, and get you as far as I can take you. Fortunately, when you get to immigration court, there's bilingual assistance, and they tell you, well, you can't go beyond this point, only the people that appear in court. So that helped him a little bit, but I guess it lessened the stress of him arriving, but not the stress of actually appearing before a judge.
Just your presence. And of course, as a journalist, a documentarian, it's probably a fine line between, am I getting involved here, am I assisting,
right.
versus, you know, telling a story and just being a good person.
Right. Well, I just know every time you have to go to downtown, you know, where do you park? You know, and just navigating
every Chicagoan.
That. So
that challenge.
It was helpful for him, I know.
So I want to play another clip from the series. This one features Emily, who made the difficult decision to travel to Chicago without two of her children. Here's a look at that.
Mis hijos en Venezuela lo entendieron de que no me alcanzaba el dinero, pero sí a veces digo, no, yo tenía que traérmelo. Tenía que traérmelos y porque ahora que estoy acá, ya tengo un año, digo, ¿cómo me los voy a traer ahora? Quiero hacer todos mis papeles rápido, quiero pagar taxes, todo, porque quiero traérmelos rápido y pedirlos. Eso quiero.
In both Emily's case, as well as that of Jose, who's working multiple jobs to provide for his family, and then, of course, for those who watch the entirety of Emily's story, you see how hard folks are working to make it work for them. What does that tell you? What did you pick up on that theme as well?
I did. I hope that people see the dignity that they're looking for, the spirit that they have. They're hard workers, sure, but they're working for their family. They're working for a better life.
Of the several I've watched, they're also very thankful to be
yes.
here. You know, despite, yeah. you know, what we've seen about, you know, their conditions once they arrive, you know, many of them living in shelters, and this series is firsthand homeless, the migrant experience, and thankfully most of them are sheltered or have a home that they are trying to make. What does that tell you about their attitude, that they are, you know, very thankful to be here and about where they came from?
They truly are. Because you have to understand that once they've arrived here, they've already went through six countries. So if they were going to feel hate or racism, they already experienced that. For many of them, the journey through Mexico was the hardest. And even seeing the Emily clip, even though I was there, it's still emotional. It's still, I guess, at the end of the day, these are real people trying to make their lives work.
Do you think people have a misunderstanding about the plight of the migrant experience, about the plight of the new arrivals?
I think if you're not willing to talk to the migrants or to watch these stories and not shamelessly promoting it, it's just you have to. That's how you understand people. You talk to them. I was telling Sean, your producer, it's interesting. In Chicago, we call ourselves a city of immigrants. And that we know each other by our food, and the neighborhoods have such an identity to immigrant communities. I think this new wave, these people are no different. And Emily, in her story, you'll find that she makes a little money cooking food outside of the shelters or at her home and selling it outside the shelters. And she's a very good cook. She was kind enough to share her soup with us and some arepas.
It looked delicious. I was watching that
absolutely.
One, too.
It was.
What were some of the challenges with establishing trust? And were some of them a bit mistrustful of someone like you who, you know, shows up and wants to tell their story?
Without a doubt. We started by showing up with a camera, and I knew that wasn't going to work because right away you know, people don't want to be on camera. And they'll ask, why are you videotaping me? Or why are you taking my picture? So I think in their own country, they're mistrustful of media. And I think coming here, as soon as they arrived, as you remember, a few months ago, everybody was outside of the police department or in tent cities.
Right.
And I think that was their first experience with news media in the city.
Which we all remember what that looked like at the time. Mm-hmm. That's where we'll have to leave it. But, of course, we can direct folks to see it. Edgar Vargas, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And, again, you can see the stories from Firsthand Homeless, The Migrant Experience at WTTW.com/firsthand. And that's our show for this Monday night. Don't forget to stay connected with us by signing up for our daily briefing. And you can get Chicago Tonight streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and our website, WTTW.com/news. You can also get the show via podcast and the PBS video app. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Chicago Teachers Union President Stacey Davis Gates joins us as the union's contract nears expiration and negotiations begin with the school district. And talking with some country music artists about queer identity and the genre. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm, and proud sponsor of programming that offers advice and strategies to enhance the physical and mental well-being of fellow legal practitioners in Illinois.